The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I particularly stand by our decision to ensure New Zealanders receive a full course of COVID-19 vaccine in the clinically recommended timeframe, which is why today we've announced that over 500,000 New Zealanders are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Mr. Speaker, we must remain vigilant, especially in the face of variants of concern, but this government's actions continue to support our recovery.
Order.
But also continues to support the health of New Zealanders.
Can she confirm her government's method for detecting if emergency housing applicants are gang members is, as her Minister for Social Development said yesterday, to quote, ask, it's on the form. And does she think a gang member will answer this truthfully?
Mr. Speaker, as I said yesterday, I think the most important thing that we need to focus on are ways that we can get around the original design of the use of motels by the last government, which did not give us the flexibility to ensure that we were placing with care children against those who may have other housing needs. And so we're working hard to do a redesign of the system that allows for that, fully contracting entire facilities and case managing in that way, as we are doing in Rotorua, is, I think, a model for how we may do things in the future. But, Mr. Speaker, again, our focus is on housing people and housing them safely, and, of course, we take into account who they are housed alongside.
Why is her government not simply using information from the Gang Intelligence Centre to identify gang members and prevent 4,000 children living alongside gang members 4 years after she took office?
Mr. Speaker, again, I would point to the fact that we are working very hard to ensure that when we are placing people, we are doing so safely. Again, if the member wishes to criticise the way in which our emergency housing system is operating as it relates to motels, her government was the first one to design it. So if she believes that it's not utilising other agencies, then that I would put to the member is because of the way in which it was first established.
What does she say to the 4,000 children currently growing up in dangerous motels who were told when she became Prime Minister of New Zealand 4 years ago that New Zealand would be the best place in the world to be a child?
Mr. Speaker, I point to the fact that there are 43,000 fewer children living in poverty under the housing cost measure because of this government. I would point to the indexation of benefits, the most significant benefit increases since benefits were established, the fact that we changed the way the in-work tax credit applies, that we established the Best Start payment, the reinstatement around the training incentive allowance. Mr. Speaker, we've seen some of the most fundamental reforms to our benefit system for decades, and I'm very proud of that. Does that mean the work is done? No. We will continue to build houses as fast as we can to address the issues that have been building over many decades, including the decade in which that member was in government.
David Seymour.
How many doses of the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine does the government have ordered, and when will they be onshore in New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, the Janssen vaccine was obviously only approved by MedSafe today, so there is still a decision to use, a process that needs to go through Cabinet. My understanding is those orders are in the vicinity of 2 million, but again, I'd say to the member, Cabinet needs to make decisions around the usage of those vaccines, but they do provide choices and opportunities for New Zealand.
Can she commit to have no children living in motels with gang members by this Christmas 4 years after she took office?
Mr. Speaker, I don't want any children living in motels at all, and that in fact is the goal of this government. We have, of course, over the last quarter, housed 1,700 people from the register, and when you look at the churn over many quarters, In the December quarter, we'd housed 2,100. The September quarter, 1,800. And then across the March quarter again before that, 1,860. We continue to house people as quickly as we can while we build houses and create transitional housing places. But I cannot tell the member how long it will take us to solve the mess she left us.
How much longer does she anticipate mental health workers will be forced to care for some of the most vulnerable patients in the country in clinically unsafe conditions, as stated by the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists?
Mr Speaker, of course, I can only make assumptions about what the member or indeed the referral there that's being made to clinically unsafe environments. But I can make an assumption, having seen some of those environments myself, across, for instance, the Waikato or across Mid-Central, that those are facilities that we are working to rebuild. That includes Waikato, Lakes, Mid-Central, a refurbishment at Tairāwhiti and Waitemata. And Mr Speaker, of course, that comes out of the budget funding that we put in only in 2019.
Question number two, Helen White.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, the primary sector is continuing to support and secure the recovery. The ANZ Commodity Price Index, which was released yesterday, rose by 0.8% in June, the ninth successive monthly increase to leave the index at a record high. The gains were broad-based, with producers benefiting from higher prices as global demand for New Zealand's commodities remains robust. Forestry extended its record highs, rising by 3.6% in June, while meat and fibre rose 1.8% and horticulture gained 4.3%. Dairy prices did ease by 1.5%, but they are still 35% higher than they were a year ago. When returns to producers are converted back to New Zealand dollars, the overall index rose by 2.3%. Nevertheless, our producers are operating in a volatile market, reflecting the impact of the pandemic.
Supplementary. What other reports has he seen on the economy?
Mr Speaker, data released today shows an increase in advertised job vacancies. TradeMe's latest jobs data shows the site recorded... No, your job hasn't been advertised yet, Mr Bailey, but it will be soon. TradeMe's latest jobs data shows the site recorded its highest number of jobs listed ever in the June quarter, increasing by 25% compared with the same period in 2019 prior to COVID. It now has more than 80,000 jobs being advertised. The largest increases were in hospitality and tourism, which rose by 56%, manufacturing and operations up 52%, and construction and roading up 46%. TradeMe said the listings did not look to be slowing down, and this shows just how strong and quickly the job market has bounced back.
Supplementary. What reports has he seen of the impact of the economy on consumer confidence?
Mr Speaker, the latest ANZ Roy Morgan Consumer Confidence Index shows consumer confidence remains steady. The index stood at 114 in June, a little under its historical average of 120. The proportion of people who believe it is a good time to buy a major household item, which is a key retail indicator of confidence, rose 3 points to plus 22. Respondents were more positive about their own financial position, jumping 7 points to plus 14%, its strongest post-COVID level. The survey does, however, show that consumers remain cautious about the future, which is completely understandable in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Question number three, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What actions, if any, does the government intend to take in response to the Treasury report entitled Tirohanga Mokopuna 2021, consultation on the draft content of the Treasury's combined statement on the long-term fiscal position and long-term insights briefing?
Mr Speaker, given that there is a consultation underway on a draft document, the initial action that I am taking is to read it and consider the feedback on it once it comes in. In terms of the issues raised within the report, the government is already taking action to provide security and certainty to New Zealanders.
To the Minister, does the report's warnings about long-term debt projections cause him to reconsider spending decisions on projects such as the $785 million cycling bridge across Waitemata Harbour?
Mr Speaker, I note that the Treasury and the report do not express any concern about the current level of debt that the government has, nor is this report about current projects.
Will he commit to reductions in structural spending from the COVID response and recovery fund that have nothing to do with COVID response and recovery?
Mr. Speaker, we will continue to use the COVID response and recovery fund for the words that are in the name of the refund, response and recovery, because that is what it's for. And I repeat my earlier answer, the Treasury's report that this question is based on is not about the current spending with which Treasury is comfortable.
What does spending $710 million on Three Waters reform and the online pornography ad campaign have to do with COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be pretty obvious to most New Zealanders that making sure that we have an efficient system, an effective system for the management of water, which helps create jobs and lowers costs on New Zealanders, is something that we'd welcome. Clearly, on the other side of the House, there is no interest whatsoever in making sure that our water system works well.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Has the Minister of Finance seen any alternative proposals for the use of the CRRF funding, such as spending all of the funding that was left on roads?
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes, I actually have done that. And in fact, that was a document that I do believe was produced by the Honourable Paul Goldsmith, which I think he dropped on the floor at one stage, but it's still probably there if members across the House want to find it.
To the Minister, has he had a discussion with Treasury officials about whether the current net debt to GDP limit could be increased given their concerns about spending?
Well, yeah, Mr. Speaker, as outlined by the Treasury Secretary in the speech that she recently gave, she does believe that it is time to have a discussion now about New Zealand's debt levels. What we do know is that this is a government that took our net debt under 20% of GDP, something that the National Party was never able to achieve. We now have debt at a higher level because of COVID, but it is forecast to reduce.
Question at 4, Paul Eagle.
My question is, tēnā koe te mangai o te whare. My question is to the Minister of Housing. What announcements has she made about transitional housing in Wellington?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday I announced the opening of the capital's largest transitional housing facility and also the biggest outside of Auckland, Wellington City Mission to Pāpuri. The government is providing $15 million over 3 years in support of these refurbished apartments and the people being housed to help them get back on their feet. This builds on the momentum of our transitional housing program by adding up to another 100 additional beds to our stock as we deliver over 18,000 new public and transitional housing places by 2024. There is much more work to do, but the opening of this facility is another important milestone on our path to achieving that goal.
Supplementary, how does this contribute to the government's ambitions for transitional housing?
Mr. Speaker, we are committed to housing the people who need the most support through our public and transitional housing plan, and we've made good progress to date. When we came into government, there were 1,718 transitional housing places. In the 3.5 years we have been in government, we have delivered 2,553 new transitional housing places, more than doubling the number of places available to 4,271. This government continues to build momentum on our public and transitional housing plan, and the opening of this facility is another important step on that pathway.
Supplementary. Why is it important that the government partner with organisations like the Wellington City Mission?
Mr. Speaker, we know that the key to bringing on more public and transitional housing is strong leadership from central government in partnership with groups like the Wellington City Mission and other community housing partners. Since coming into office, the government has spent $471.6 million for accommodation and support services in partnership with these organisations. Having a safe and secure place to stay with provision of the right support services from these organisations is crucial to ensuring that people can transition to long-term suitable housing.
Question number 5, Brooke Van Velden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing for Māori Housing. how many houses are projected to be built and by when at the land at Ihumato?
The Honourable Penny Hanare.
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. A Memorandum of Understanding, He Pūmautanga, has been signed by the Kingitanga, the Crown and Auckland Council, which sets out how parties will work together to decide the future of the land, and I do not wish to preempt this process. It is important to note, the member might want to listen, this is a good koha. It is important to note that parties have committed that there will be housing on the site, and we are continuing to work through this process.
Supplementary. Does the minister believe it is acceptable that over 6 months on from the government signing a memorandum of understanding with Kingitanga and Auckland Council for the land at Ihumato, the Minister of Housing has not met with either Kingitanga or Auckland Council?
Mr Speaker, we make no apology for taking the time to get this right. That side might want to listen. The Treaty of Waitangi over 180 years, it's taken a long time to come to where we are now. If that member is referring directly to the land at Ihumātau, I can reassure that member that I've met with the Kingitanga, I have met with those who are out at the Ahika out at Ihumātau, and I've also met with the council in the time that I've been responsible for Māori housing.
Supplementary. Can he confirm that the land will still be used for housing, as was agreed to and announced on the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding between the Government, Kingitanga and Auckland Council?
A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr Speaker, it may just be me, but I wasn't clear if the Minister was answering. Actually, Mr Speaker, I've made a mistake and shouldn't have raised this point of order. Very sorry.
Mr Speaker? Yes.
Can he confirm whether over 6 months on from the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding that the steering committee has been formed?
Right now, Mr Speaker, with respect to He Pūmautanga, we are working with the Kingitanga and Ahika to establish the Rōpū Whakahaere.
Supplementary. When can we expect the steering committee, consisting of 6 representatives representing or supporting the Crown and Kingitanga, to be formed?
Mr Speaker, I have it on the good authority of my colleague to my right here, that we will be looking to push this kaupapa along, and my expectation is that in the very near future we will have an announcement.
Supplementary. How many houses can be built at the land at Ihumātau, given the agreement the government has signed and council zoning?
Mr Speaker, I refer back to my first answer to the primary question, which actually establishes that He Pūmautanga are to sit down together to establish the use of that land, which the expectation of the government as part of it will be for housing.
Supplementary. Does he know of any private developers that have spent $30 million and have produced no plans for housing?
Mr Speaker, no.
Question number 6, Anahita Kanongataha Surisuiki.
Oh, kia ora te mana whakawā. Ki te minita o te whanaketanga hapori me te whiwhinga mahi. What recent expansions has she launched to support more graduates into employment?
Mr Speaker, last night I had the pleasure of hosting the launch of the Student Job Search expansion. The expansion follows investment by the Ministry of Social Development to support Student Job Search to create a new team. This team will be solely focused on working with graduates to connect them with employers and place them in permanent employment. This expansion boosts Student Job Search's focus on helping students transition from study into full-time employment and supporting employers to scale up their businesses. The government is committed to securing our recovery, which is why we're continuing to invest in employment products and services that support people into sustainable and meaningful jobs.
Pātai Tāpiri, why has Student Job Search been expanded?
Mr Speaker, The expansion is a response to a growth in inquiries from students looking for permanent work after graduating from study in light of COVID-19. It signals a shift in the mahi of student job search, which has traditionally been a place that tertiary students can go to find part-time work and odd jobs while they study. As part of the expansion, they've been working closely with Te Mana Akunga and Tauira Pacific. This has seen an increase in Māori and Pacific registration rates of 14.8%. The expansion means student job search can continue to advocate for students after they have graduated. By championing their skills and qualifications and preparing them for job interviews, this will help and encourage them to make the most of the opportunities available.
Pātai Tāpiri, what impact has student job search had on supporting students and graduates to get employed?
Mr Speaker, student job search is a household name. It has helped to place students into 159,798 jobs for 61,886 New Zealand employers since 2015. That's more than 100 jobs each working day. Over the last 3 months, student job search has secured 3,742 full-time roles for students, a 200% increase on previous years. The quality of the jobs they are sourcing has also drastically increased, with the average student earnings per job increasing by 46% since May 2020. I'm pleased that this expansion will support student job search to maximise its reach and offerings, making a worthwhile impact in the lives of our young people. They were so excited that this question was being asked about student job search today. They are here in the House and I acknowledge them for their mahi.
Order. The member knows or should know that she'd not should not refer to people in the gallery. Question number 7, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she have confidence the government is doing all it can to make sure children in emergency housing are safe? If so, why?
Mr Speaker, we need to keep in mind that the Emergency Housing Special Needs Grant was only introduced in 2016 by the then national governments in response to the number of New Zealanders who found themselves sleeping in cars or on the streets. At that point in time, there was no thought given to wraparound support services or the suitability of accommodation options. We've spent the last 3.5 years working to improve the system we inherited. In recent months, that has meant taking a more localised approach, like in Rotorua, where we have begun a new way of working that will involve cohorting of families to improve wraparound support and safety. No government can give absolute assurances that we can keep all New Zealanders safe in all places at all times. However, the government will always do everything it can to improve safety for New Zealanders. That includes those in emergency housing.
Supplementary. Why is the government relying on gangs to self-declare their membership rather than using the Gang Intelligence Centre information to prevent gangs being placed in the same motels as children?
Mr Speaker, I think that that member knows that gangs taking up emergency accommodation is not a huge issue in our regions. And so it seems, Mr Speaker, that it's just an attempt to demonise those that are in emergency accommodation. Mr Speaker, when people apply for emergency housing grant, they are asked whether or not they have gang affiliation. Mr Speaker, you cannot force people to tick yes to that question. Ministry for Social Development and Emergency Housing is the last port of call for all New Zealanders when they find themselves homeless. At times, that is also gang members, Mr Speaker. And so, Mr Speaker, I do want to remind the House, though, that none of my regional commissioners have highlighted a massive increase or any type of increase in gang members seeking emergency accommodation.
Point of order.
A point of order. Thank
you, Mr Speaker. I was quite careful in specifically using the words the Gang Intelligence Centre information, and I don't recall the Minister addressing that question that I asked, sir.
I think that's fair. It's a very full response to a different question. I'll get the member to ask the question again.
Why is the government relying on gangs to self-declare their membership rather than using the Gang Intelligence Centre information to prevent gangs being placed in the same motels as children?
Mr Speaker, we have not had it raised by our regional commissioners out in the regions that gang access to emergency accommodation is a concern or that it's heightened in any way, Mr Speaker. And so, Mr Speaker, we have not sought out that information that the member is asking for. As I said, we have a self-declare system in place, and that is what we're using at this moment.
Supplementary. Do the regional commissioners talk to the local police officers on a regular basis?
Mr Speaker, yes they do, and it's also important to note that where issues do arise in emergency accommodation, keeping in mind that they are seldom and far between and they're of course not always gang members, that it is up to the police to then respond to those criminal matters, not up to MSD to respond to that.
Supplementary. How can she have confidence children are safe when a May police briefing says there are reports of, and I quote, violence, intimidation, public urination, drug deals and gang involvement, unquote, at emergency housing that MSD is using?
Mr Speaker, there have been instances of all those things, but we can't conflate them into just being with gang members, Mr Speaker. Family violence is an issue that we face inside emergency housing at some times and also in private households, Mr Speaker. So we can't put this down to gang membership and gang members necessarily accessing emergency accommodation.
Supplementary. How can this government claim it's improving children's lives when over 4,300 children have been placed into motels 3.5 years after they came into government, and they're still not taking basic precautions like using gang intelligence information about keeping those children safe from harm?
Mr Speaker, we as a government are taking far more precautions than what the previous national government were taking when they set up the emergency special needs grant, Mr Speaker. As we have gone on, we have continued to improve the system. The response to Rotorua, which is highly localised, is in response to our coordination with social services, with council, with iwi on the ground. We are moving in that particular area to a cohorted model so that we can ensure that children and families are located in the same place. And as the Prime Minister said earlier, that is a model that we are seeking to also roll out. Keeping in mind there was no system in place when the national government implemented this, no wraparound support systems in place, and no regard for whether or not the accommodation was appropriate or suitable.
Question number 8, Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries. What announcements has the government made regarding oceans and fisheries?
The Honourable Speaker, David Parker.
Last week the government announced a ministerial inquiry into the use and allocation of migrant labour in the seafood sector. The inquiry will focus on the sector's reliance on migrant labour and how to transition it away from that reliance. We'll also examine how to accelerate efforts to attract more New Zealanders into rewarding jobs in the seafood sector. It will consider commercial seafood activities, including deep sea fishing, inshore fishing, aquaculture and seafood processing. The COVID-19 border restrictions have highlighted the sector's vulnerability due to its reliance on migrant labour. While businesses in the sector have worked to reduce that reliance, some deep sea vessels in particular are still 100% foreign crewed. This work will provide information needed to understand where improvements can be made so that the industry can be more resilient and more New Zealanders can have the opportunity to participate.
Supplementary. How is the government integrating oceans and fisheries policies?
The Prime Minister created this portfolio in 2020 to focus on ocean ecosystems as a whole. In response, we've begun a coordinated approach to address ocean sustainability issues through a raft of programs and initiatives. Our vision is to ensure the long-term health and resilience of oceans and coastal ecosystems, including the role of fisheries. Our vision for the oceans, as I've said, includes the role of fisheries, commercial and otherwise. The jobs the industry provides are important to many communities, and high-quality products sent around the world earn valuable export dollars. We've got a cross-agency coordination group comprising officials from DOC, Primary Industries, Ministry for the Environment and other agencies as appropriate.
What other announcements has the government made regarding oceans and fisheries?
Mr Speaker, there's been a suite of initiatives in the last month. This has included our announcements on plans for the Hauraki Gulf. We've set out the funding and timeline for the implementation of cameras on boats for the inshore fishing fleet. We've announced changes around rules about dumping of fish at sea. We've set out how we're going to modernise fisheries regulations and have laid out our initial response to the Prime Minister's Chief Science Report on commercial fishing. This has been done at pretty fast pace, but there's still quite a bit more to do. And I thank stakeholders and officials, including the industry, for their participation to date.
The Honourable Eugenie Sage.
How does the Minister propose to protect the seafloor and seabed sediments in New Zealand waters as an important storehouse for carbon from the impacts of bottom trawling, which creates plumes of sediments and mobilises carbon?
Mr Speaker, we've already laid out plans to restrict the areas of trawling within the Hauraki Gulf area to corridors that are yet to be specified but will be significantly reduced in area compared with current trawling effort. In respect of bottom trawling in the deep sea, we're not proposing to ban it. We will look at issues as to whether we should have restrictions on what I think is in the media today as virgin areas being trawled, bottom trawled, and whether we should be holding bottom trawling to the areas that have previously been bottom trawled. And we'll also work with the industry to improve technologies so as to minimise damage. In terms of sediment issues, a lot of those are land-based, but I would agree with the member that they need to be addressed too.
Rauru Waititi.
How does the minister uphold mātaitai that have been signed off but challenged by the commercial fishers in that particular area?
Well, I take advice where applications are made for the establishment of mātaitai areas, and there are a number in New Zealand that have been successfully established and operate well. There are sometimes disagreements as to proposals for new ones, and where there are disagreements, I take advice from fisheries officials and run a fair process to work those issues through.
Before I call question 9, I've just advised the House that I have been advised by the Minister that because this answer is somewhat technical, it is even longer than she normally gives. Ricardo Menendez-March.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, how many people, if any, receiving unabated main benefits will not see a net increase of $20 in their bank account weekly as a result of the July increase to main benefits?
Mr. Speaker, the short answer is all people on a main benefit receive a net increase of $20, and that was effective as of the 1st of July. Keeping in mind, though, that benefits are paid in arrears, and so it won't be in full effect until next week when they get the full payment that they are entitled to. However, I believe the member is asking whether supplementary assistance, such as accommodation supplement and temporary additional support, will be affected by the $20 rise in benefits. The system we use to pay income support is complicated, and we are undertaking a longer-term project to simplify it. Supplementary assistance is also available to working people, therefore how much an individual is eligible for depends on how much they earn and what their costs are. If someone's wages or benefit goes up, then their supplementary assistance will adjust depending on these costs. But when temporary additional support falls, it is not abated dollar for dollar for beneficiaries. The formula is more complicated. From the 1st of July, those who received a benefit increase of $20 could find themselves better off per week by $26 when supplementary assistance adjusts. Others who have lower weekly costs may find themselves better off per week by around $15 per week. I'm not able to give the exact figure the member asked for because the number of people on benefit changes daily and not everyone will have received their full increase yet, as benefits, as I said, are paid in arrears. Also important to mention that the modelling
originally used by MSD and Treasury during the budget process, modelled assuming 372,000 would be receiving a benefit as of the 1st of July, when the actual number is closer to 354,000. So it is complicated, but the reality is that the vast majority of people are going to be better off, and we look forward to April 1st next year when the full increase kicks in.
Supplementary. How many people will not receive the full extra $20 a week in hand because they also get the accommodation supplement, temporary additional support, and another payment to meet the cost of living? And this is not just about those better off.
Mr. Speaker, so the majority of people will be better off. There's only 125 people out of the 354,000 that will not be better off. But what I have asked, and they will get a temporary additional payment in place to ensure that they're no worse off. But what I have asked MSD to do, and what they will be doing, is in the next few weeks doing a point in time study to actually ascertain the brackets in terms of how much people are better off. But the vast majority, more than $15 a week, and as I said, some will be better off by 26 weeks. In fact, I've been told some may be better off by 29 weeks, when $29 per week when the adjustments are actually made.
Supplementary. Will the top-up provided to people who would otherwise be worse off with benefit increases as a result of the complex interaction between benefits and supplementary assistance lift their benefits so they now receive a full additional $20 a week in hand?
Mr. Speaker, my understanding is that it ensures that they don't fall below what they're currently getting. So that 125 people out of the 354,000 will not fall below. And my understanding is once the increase kicks in on the 1st of April, then they will be better off.
Supplementary. Can the Minister confirm if there will be people who will not be receiving a net increase in their bank account of at least $20?
Everyone will get a net increase in their bank account of $20, but how it affects their supplementary supports is different. But as I said, the vast majority of people will be better off by at least $15 per week, and some even upwards of $26 per week.
Debbie Nariwa-Packer.
Does she agree with Auckland Action Against Poverty coordinator Brooke Fiafia that the recent $20 benefit increase that some aren't yet receiving is trash more than transformational?
Mr. Speaker, no, I don't. If it was just one $20 benefit increase that we were putting into place, then that would be insufficient. But we've had a program of work in welfare reform that has been running since we started. We've seen the indexation of benefits to wages, which will see them go up more every year. We had a $25 increase last year. We've repealed one major sanction and are on the verge of repealing another major sanction. We have made changes to the culture and the way that MSD works with clients. We've lifted abatement thresholds so that people can earn more without losing the benefit like they were before. And we've got more benefit increases coming into effect on April 1st. Those are only some of the changes. No one change is transformational, but the program of work that we have had underway is transformational.
Question number 10, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the Minister for COVID-19 response. What percentage of people living in residential care have not had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine? And is he satisfied with the vaccine rollout in New Zealand?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, the number of people in residential care is not static, so a specific percentage is impossible to calculate with accuracy. However, I can confirm that of the 668 aged residential care facilities across the country, all but seven facilities have received at least their first dose of the vaccine. DHBs are working closely with the remaining seven facilities who are scheduled to receive their first dose of the vaccine in the coming weeks. In regards to the second part of the member's question, yes.
Why has Canterbury, the country's second biggest region by population, only administered 7,310 doses to those in Group 3, as per the numbers he's released today, when down the road, the South Canterbury DHB has delivered more?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that people who live in aged residential care facilities are in fact in Group 2 rather than Group 3. So in reference to the primary question, it is irrelevant.
Sorry, sir.
point of order, Mr Speaker.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
That does not address the question at all, and it's well within the scope because the second leg of the primary is he satisfied with the vaccine rollout in New Zealand, and I asked about Group 3 in Canterbury and South Canterbury.
Okay, and it's been long established in the House that if the member wants a specific answer, he should put down a specific question. And having a general throwaway, is he satisfied, is not enough to get the Minister to bring that level of detail to the House.
But it's okay if we go on TV and talk about it.
Thank you for your support, Mr Browning. Mr Bishop.
Why has the Canterbury DHB only administered just over 7,000 doses to those in Group 3 of the vaccine rollout?
Mr Speaker, it is fair to say that the different DHBs have different... the size of the population in Groups 1 and 2 is different in each DHB level, and that will have an impact on the number of doses they've delivered in Group 3.
Why are there still National Health Index number matching problems for the vaccination status of border workers, and how many are in the unvaccinated group that he said today the government was still chasing down?
Mr Speaker, my understanding is that as the team have looked through the individual records of people who are showing up in the border worker testing register as unvaccinated, they have found that some of those workers have been vaccinated, but the data isn't matching correctly to pull through their vaccination register into the border worker testing register. They're working to resolve that issue and where possible, to manually match to ensure that the border worker testing register is as up-to-date as possible.
So how many workers are there at the front line working at the border who have not been vaccinated?
Mr Speaker, it sits somewhere around about 15% of the overall active workers on the border worker testing
Order.
Register.
Order!
Oh, the member from, sorry. Question number 11, Rachel Boyack.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. What progress has been made on replacing the Inter-Islander ferries?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, I'm pleased to confirm that we are another step closer to replacing our ageing Inter-Islander fleet. KiwiRail has now formally signed a contract with Korea's Hyundai Mipo Dockyard to build two new Inter-Islander ferries. The new ferries are expected to arrive in New Zealand in 2025 and 2026 and will help reduce transport emissions and support more goods and people crossing the Cook Strait.
Supplementary. What benefits will they have for our environment?
Mr Speaker, our transport emissions are the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand, so we need to start taking action now if we're going to meet our 2050 targets. These new ferries will reduce the Inter-Island's carbon emissions by 40% with initiatives like using battery power for manoeuvring. They are also future-proof so that more batteries can be added over time and can be modified to run on other low-carbon fuels like hydrogen as they become available in the future.
Supplementary. How will the new ferries cater for growth?
The Cooks... Mr Goldsmith has been consulting a spreadsheet, and it's right for once. The Cook Strait ferries are crucial to our economy, carrying 5.5 million tonnes of freight and 850,000 passengers between the North and South Islands every year. The new ferries nearly double passenger capacity and triple rail freight capacity of the current fleet, helping support the expected growth on this important route. Being able to accommodate rail wagons on the new ferries will encourage more freight onto trains and off roads, which will also help to reduce
Order.
Emissions and congestion on our busy roads.
Question number 12, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing, Public Housing. When, if ever, have there been more people on the public housing register waiting to be housed than there were in the official figures for March 2021? And by what date will she commit to a reduction in the number of people waiting to be housed?
The Honourable
Speaker,
Potter Williams.
The waiting list reflects the strong emphasis we have placed on people coming forward and telling us if they need housing support.
As the member has said, our housing challenges have built up over successive governments. And if you look back on the graph about where...
Order. I'm just going to say, I'd like the Leader of the Opposition, who's been pretty loud today, just to wind it back as an example to, especially to a couple of people not very far away from her, no, not Mr. Retty, not Dr. Retty, who are making quite a lot of noise today. I think this is an area which the Opposition would like to continue their questioning on. Potter Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the member has said, our housing challenges have built up over successive governments. And if you look back on the graph about when it all started going badly wrong, that was about 1991. The wait list is the largest it's been, which is why the government has committed to the largest public housing build program in decades, with over 18,000 additional public and transitional homes to be built and delivered by 2024. I will not be committing to a specific date for a reduction. Instead, I'm committed to our build program, which the member has acknowledged gets it right.
Supplementary. What responsibility, if any, does she take for the State House waiting list more than quadrupling since Labor came to office?
Mr. Speaker, what I do accept is that if the National Party and government had built the numbers of houses that were required, we wouldn't be in the state that we are in. If they had even just built 6,000 houses, that our housing register waiting list would not be as high as it is. There's no doubt that there is more to do, and that's why we have committed to building 18,000 public and transitional houses. And I'm very supportive of that program, as is the member herself.
Supplementary?
Nicola Willis.
Why has the number of people classified as having the highest possible housing risk leapt from 3 in December 2017 to 198 today? And does she think it's acceptable that those at-risk people will now spend an average 6 months on the waiting list?
Mr. Speaker, it's not acceptable that our people have to wait, and that's why this government is investing billions in the public housing program. We're on track to fund and deliver over 18,000 new and public and transitional houses. And if I could, Mr. Speaker, just refer to that member's own comments, that she herself would stick to the state housing build program of this current government.
Can she confirm that most of the new public housing spaces her government claims to have created are not new builds, but instead are existing homes that have been taken out of the private market for use as state housing? And how does that help solve New Zealand's housing shortage?
Mr. Speaker,
the member better apologise to his colleague pretty quickly. Now, order. Order. Mr. Goldsmith's going to stand, withdraw and apologise.
Oh, I withdraw and apologise.
I absolutely reject that member's, the premise of that member's question.
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Thank you. Has the member heard any alternative plans from any other organisations about how to solve the issue of having more public houses in New Zealand? Or is she going on the opposition spokesperson's comment on TV this week, I'd stick to the state house building programme of this current government?
A point of order.
The minister has no responsibility for opposition spokespeople's statements.
Yeah, that's true, but there's a question of whether she was going to use an alternative to it or not.
Mr. Speaker, I have not heard any alternatives. In fact, the only alternative I've heard is that member has said that she would stick to the state house building program currently in progress.
Nicola Willis.
Was she advised that the government's new housing tax policies could increase the number of people on the housing register and in emergency housing? And if so, why is the government pressing ahead with this change at a time of record state housing waiting lists?
Mr. Speaker,
We were very clear in our housing policy that we preference first home buyers, and there is no evidence to suggest that people are being disadvantaged and accessing the public housing waiting list as a result of that. I refute what the member says, and I would encourage the member to keep supporting the government in its housing build programme.
That concludes our questions.